Hi, everybody. I have something a bit different for you this week, and that is in large part because the hosts of the New Yorker political scene are off on vacation, which is a real shame because I was so curious to hear what they were going to say about Zohran Mamdani winning the Democratic primary for the mayor of New York City. I'm sure they'll be discussing it at some point in the not-so-distant future, though, which is something I'll very much be looking forward to. But in the meantime, I hope they are sipping some frosty piña coladas and catching some rays, wherever they are. In the meantime, I wanted to give you my 2 cents on Zohran's win and what it means for the city and for left-wing politics in this country. It's been over a week now, and so I'm sure you've heard lots of reactions and analysis, some of it completely deranged, panicked, and frankly racist from Republicans and liberals alike. And folks, there's nothing I love more than watching conservatives and the liberal establishment melt down as their entire worldview is shattered before their eyes. And we'll get to some of that, but before we do, let's go over what actually happened in this race. If you're not aware of New York political journalist Michael Lang, I highly recommend you check out his Substack called The Narrative Wars, where he does a lot of quite granular reporting on New York City politics that goes neighborhood by neighborhood and demographic by demographic in a way that is infinitely more informative and grounded in reality than the 30,000-foot analysis you might get from pundits on cable news channels like CNN or MSNBC, who actually don't know much about the politics of this city. Since Zohran's win, Lang has written a guest essay for the New York Times, been on lots of TV news shows, and was interviewed by New York Magazine, who are all now turning to his reporting for insight about how Zohran's official campaign and the New York chapter of the Democratic Socialists of America were able to pull off this historic upset. As Lang wrote in his post-election day analysis, the first step of Mamdani's successful campaign was rallying his base, namely young people from all race and class backgrounds. Over a million people voted in this election, which is the biggest turnout for a Democratic primary in several decades. Just to give you a sense, in the last mayoral race, just under 1,150,000 people turned out for the general election that resulted in Eric Adams' win. So the turnout in this primary came close to matching the turnout in the last general election for mayor. That is stunning. Zohran got 545,000 votes after the ranked choice ballots were counted, around 120,000 more votes than Andrew Cuomo, who got 428,500. By the way, Eric Adams won in the general election in 2021 with just over 750,000 votes, so only about 200,000 more votes than Zohran got in this primary, just among registered Democrats. And keep in mind that Adams got about 66% of the vote in that general election because his only real opponent was the Republican nominee, legendary New York goofball, vigilante, and right-wing radio host Curtis Sliwa. More about him later. So the New York Board of Elections has published the age breakdown of the voters in this primary, and as Lang reports, young people are really one of the most significant parts of this story, especially when you consider that their overwhelming support for Zohran transcends race and class. The biggest turnout in this election were people between the ages of 25 and 34, who made up more than 21% of the electorate. After that were people ages 34 to 44, who made up just under 17% of the votes. You also have more than 72,000 voters between the ages of 18 and 24. So that's a total of more than 45% of the electorate who are under the age of 45. Historically, the most significant voting bloc in a primary election in New York City, like in most of the country, is people who are between the ages of 55 and 75. That has historically been the most reliable voters for Democrats, and as a result of that, and the lobbying groups that influence Democratic politics, it's why we have an increasingly decrepit and captured establishment of the Democratic Party. So in that sense alone, this election marks a turning point in what is possible in American politics. And I think more important than Zohran's charisma, or his position on Israel and Palestine, which has gotten a disproportionate amount of attention, what his campaign is really about is affordability, lowering the cost of living in the city for working-class people. I'm sure by now you've heard about his plans to freeze the rent for rent-stabilized apartments, to make buses and childcare free, and to establish city-owned grocery stores, and to pay for these things by increasing taxes on the wealthiest New Yorkers. Now, you might have heard some pundits try to dismiss Zohran's historic win by saying his base of support is really just college-educated white voters in Brooklyn and parts of Manhattan, and somehow this movement is not reflective of the city at large, especially the working class. Not true if you look at the actual information which is diligently laid out in Michael Lang's reporting. Zoran won Brooklyn and Manhattan, which wasn't terribly surprising if you were paying attention, but it's worth looking at what played out in Queens, the Bronx, and Staten Island to give you a better sense of how specific demographics voted. I'm going to read now from Lang's blog post breaking down Zoran's win, and forgive me for reading this somewhat long excerpt, but I think it's worth hearing about some of the specifics of Zoran's coalition. Mamdani won Queens County, historically the bellwether of the New York City mayoral race, because of pronounced support from Asian voters. He won the working-class Chinatown of Elmhurst by 21 points, the ethnic and immigrant polyglot of Jackson Heights by 26 points, Indo-Caribbean and Punjabi Richmond Hill by 10 points, the diverse middle-class battleground of Briarwood by 17 points, and Little Bangladesh in Jamaica Hills by 53 points. Mamdani also did well in mixed-race Hispanic and Asian neighborhoods, such as working-class Woodhaven by 9 points, majority homeowner Ozone Park by 29 points, and the industrial waterfront of College Point by 8 points. Mamdani pointed to Bernie Sanders' 42% on Staten Island in the 2016 Democratic primary as proof that an economic populist could resonate anywhere. Ironically, Mamdani may have undersold the potential for said inroads, given he came within 9 points of Cuomo on the Forgotten Borough, a massive no-show for the frontrunner. Mamdani performed best along the racially mixed North Shore and in union-dense homeowning precincts along the Eastern Shore. On the Southern Shore, Mamdani even won a couple of blocks of Tottenville, a suburban, mostly Italian neighborhood of civil servants that gave 83% of their votes to Donald Trump last November. In southern Brooklyn, Mamdani swept Bensonhurst by 9 points and Bath Beach by 5 points, enclaves with growing Chinese and declining Italian populations, despite the local political machine working on Cuomo's behalf. In Brighton Beach, well known for their Ukrainian and Russian population, Mamdani won almost exclusively off the newfound strength of the previously dormant local Muslim voting bloc. Both of these immigrant enclaves, Muslims incensed by the war in Gaza, Chinese Americans concerned about quality of life, experienced significant movement toward the GOP over the past 4 years. In the Bronx, the first South Asian and Muslim candidate for mayor rode the Bangladeshi vote to a victory in Westchester Square by 37 points and Norwood by 8 points. Were Mamdani's appeal confined to the urban professional class, he would not have swept almost every precinct in Bed-Stuy, Bushwick, and Hamilton Heights. Andrew Cuomo, once predicted to have a considerable advantage among working-class voters of all ages and races, was reduced to a coalition heavily reliant upon a decreasing number of black seniors. In Harlem, Mamdani easily won Dunbar Apartments, the first large cooperative built for African Americans. Across Brooklyn and Upper Manhattan, that story was told hundreds of times over. Neighborhoods and assembly districts, comfortably won by Eric Adams 4 years ago, were overwhelmingly backing Zoran Mamdani. The Democratic Socialist ran up the score, even in less gentrified parts of said neighborhoods, evidence that Mamdani's coalition was one of age and class, not necessarily race. Okay, so we understand that Zoran is 33, that he's a cool and smart and well-spoken young man with a charming smile. I'm sure by now you've seen how liberal pundits are trying to make it seem like his inroads with young people and so-called low-propensity voters have more to do with his social media savvy than with his policies. And the truth is, Zoran is a generational talent who is an incredibly effective and disciplined communicator. He is always hammering that affordability message. And yes, his video team absolutely knocked it out of the park. But I am here to tell you that the idea that his win is mostly about effective communication is, I'm sorry, bullshit. So how did Zoran manage to crush a Democratic machine, a former New York governor whose name is ubiquitous in this city, and who is supported by the real estate industry, billionaires like Michael Bloomberg and Bill Ackman, DoorDash, Airbnb, and the Israel lobby? First and foremost, it's worth understanding Zoran's political origin story, which is also the story of the rise since 2018 of the New York chapter of the Democratic Socialists of America. Zoran became a member of the DSA in 2017 and says he first began to call himself a Democratic Socialist, like a lot of us, in 2016 during Bernie Sanders' first presidential campaign. He has worked on the campaigns of multiple DSA city council and state legislature races and in 2019 was endorsed by the DSA for his state assembly race to represent the Astoria and Long Island City neighborhoods in Queens. All this to say, Zoran is very much a product of the New York City chapter of the DSA as anything, and it's that same small but mighty organization that fueled his campaign in this primary. It's the organization where Zoran cut his teeth in politics, and it's the organization that recruited him for this campaign last year. Now, for the record, the DSA and the Zoran campaign are two separate entities, but suffice it to say that Zoran's campaign was really kicked into gear when the DSA's membership voted to endorse him, and that many of the people who hold top positions inside the campaign are DSA members with years of experience running previous campaigns. So after nominating Zoran, the DSA started to organize a canvassing effort focused on the DSA's base of support. These are neighborhoods, for the most part, who have elected DSA officials in the city and state government. As the campaign grew and Zoran's name recognition spread throughout the city, the organization began to broaden its efforts. Now, it's worth saying here that most political campaigns target voters with their canvassing efforts, and by canvassing, I mean knocking on people's doors, texting, or calling them, by targeting what are referred to generally as triple prime voters. These are people who are the most likely to vote because they've voted in the last three primaries. But the DSA, taking a page from Bernie Sanders' strategy, has aimed to broaden its reach in order to get lower propensity voters and non-voters to vote. In Zoran's campaign, the DSA's leaders said that beyond the triple primes, their canvassing efforts also focused on younger voters, South Asian voters, and Muslim voters in particular. In total, more than 50,000 people have volunteered for the Zoran Mamdani campaign. That's one in 200 New Yorkers knocking on doors, standing on corners and telling their neighbors about him, and not just in the weeks leading up to Election Day, but for months. So how did the campaign recruit and organize these 50,000 volunteers? Well, that is also a major part of the story I don't think is getting nearly enough attention. So the New York DSA uses a tiered system to organize its campaign volunteers, with a few dozen people coordinating all of the volunteers in a particular district, a larger number of volunteers coordinating within specific neighborhoods, and then field leaders who are organizing specific canvassing events. And at the ground level, you have ordinary rank-and-file canvassers, people like me, who are volunteering to go door-to-door or engage people at places like farmers markets or street corners or on the way to polling places. In order to be a canvasser for Zoran, you just need to be motivated enough to sign up, complete a quick training session, and then you're on your way to canvassing. That's it. It's actually a pretty high amount of trust that the campaign is putting in the hands of ordinary people who simply care enough to donate their time to the cause. It's worth mentioning here that I don't think there's any way you're going to get 50,000 volunteers in a mayor's race anywhere in the world unless your platform is really inspiring to a lot of people, enough to get them to schlep around and bother strangers on your behalf for free. That's why it's nonsense to think that just any centrist candidate could somehow borrow Zoran's strategy. Because basically, the sheer amount of volunteers has a lot to do with the political project. In this case, freezing the rent for rent-stabilized apartments, free childcare, and free buses. You can't simply swap out the ideological commitments and get the same result. Though it's also worth pointing out that Zoran did get $8 million for his campaign through small dollar donations and matching funds. Of course, that pales in comparison to the $20 million that was raised by Andrew Cuomo's Super PAC, which included $5 million from Michael Bloomberg and contributions from other billionaire ghouls like Bill Ackman, as well as DoorDash in the real estate lobby. Anyway, they might as well have just lit that money on fire, as it turns out. And this, I think, is a very troubling development for the establishment Democrats. Let's call them conservative Democrats, actually, because that's what they are. You've probably already heard the panicked, xenophobic reactions from people like New York Senator Kirsten Gillibrand or New York Congressman and House Democratic Leader Hakeem Jeffries, or the very nothing responses from New York Senator and Democratic Leader in the Senate, Chuck Schumer. These people are freaking out. Why? Because they understand they are losing control over the party, and most importantly, the business model of the party, which is essentially to serve as a fundraising operation that relies on the support of rich people, corporations, old people, and the Israel lobby to function. But that is all changing pretty dramatically now, at least in the biggest city in the country. So let's hone in now on what has become one of the central issues in this race, which is Israel. Now you might be asking yourself, Why is Israel, a foreign country on the other side of the planet from New York City, such an important issue in a mayoral race? It's not like the mayor of New York really has any significant impact on the United States government's foreign policy. A good faith reading of the situation might point to the fact that New York has the biggest population of Jews of any city in the world outside of Tel Aviv. Or maybe you could point to Zohran's long history of advocacy for Palestinians as a reason. In fact, the first time I ever was aware of Zohran was when I heard him speak at a Jewish Voices for Peace protest in 2021. Here's part of that speech.
The thing that we all know here but must be spoken. Anti-Zionism is not anti-Semitism. And so if you have any hatred in your soul, this is not the place for you. And if you seek to malign us as having that, then you are simply lying.
It's remarkable how consistent Zohran's message has been on this issue. He basically was denouncing the crimes being carried out by Israel against the Palestinians, but at the same time declaring that there is zero room for anti-Semitism in the anti-Zionist movement. He clearly is and always has been opposed to anti-Semitism. Now, the Israel lobby and the politicians they support, including the most powerful leaders of the Democratic Party, have tried to use Zohran's position on Israel and Palestine to smear him as some kind of anti-Semite. And listener, it brings me great joy to report that those efforts have failed. And their failure to take down Zohran over his willingness to call out what we can all see with our own eyes as a horrific genocide being carried out by Israel in Gaza, I think represents a turning point in American politics, which will absolutely have serious implications for Israel at some point. For example, Zohran has said that as mayor, he would have Netanyahu arrested in compliance with international law if the Israeli prime minister were to set foot in New York. But I'm talking about beyond that. Here is CNN's Harry Enten breaking down a recent poll on how dramatically Democrats have changed their minds when it comes to Israel and Palestine.
Andrew Cuomo, during the primary, attacked Mamdani as being insufficiently pro-Israel. I'm not quite sure the former governor understood how much the politics have changed around this issue among Democrats. What are we talking about here? All right, who Democrats sympathize more with, Israelis or Palestinians? In 2017, the Democratic Party was a pro-Israeli party. Look at this. They sympathized with the Israelis by 13 points, more with the Israelis than the Palestinians. But look at this sea change. Now Democrats sympathize more with the Palestinians by 43 points. Oh, my God, that is a change in the margin of 56 points over the course of just 8 years. So all of a sudden, it's the pro-Palestinian position that actually reigns supreme in Democratic politics, not the Israeli position. And that is part of the reason why Mamdani was able to do so well in this primary, because those attacks over Israel, simply put, did not ring true for Democrats. They're now on the side of the Palestinians, not the Israelis. So take a look here. Who age 18 to 49 Democrats sympathize more with, the Israelis or the Palestinians? Again, in 2017, younger Democrats sympathize more with the Israelis by 14 points. Look at this shift now. Palestinians, they sympathize more with the Palestinians by 57 points. That is an over 70-point shift in the margin in just a matter of 8 years. So the bottom line is, Mamdani's base within the Democratic Party and the base of the Democratic Party of younger voters, younger Democrats, have changed tremendously on this issue in 8 years' time. I rarely ever see shifts like this, Kate, in which you see one side of the equation leading by 14 points 8 years ago, and then all of a sudden the other side of the equation leading by 57 points. The bottom line is the politics around the Israelis and the Palestinians have shifted tremendously among Democrats, and they've shifted specifically tremendously among Democrats who are under the age of 50.
All this to say, Zohran is now very likely to become the first anti-Zionist mayor of the largest city in the United States. I don't think it's a stretch to imagine we are at most a couple of election cycles away from an anti-Zionist president. And just imagine what that would mean for Israel's ability to continue to exist as an apartheid state. This brings me to one of the other heroes of this moment, Brad Lander. In case you aren't aware, Brad Lander was also a candidate for the Democratic nomination for mayor, and is also a progressive who has a long history with the New York City DSA. He also happens to be Jewish. Many of the left-wing elected officials, including AOC, endorsed Lander as their second-choice candidate on the ranked-choice ballot after Zohran. it's worth pointing out that Lander is very much not an anti-Zionist and disagrees with some of the things that Zohran has said about Israel and Palestine. But when push came to shove, Lander, who got 11% of the first round of ranked choice voting, mind you, has proven himself to be a movement politician first and foremost. He understood that the moment called on him to use his positionality and platform as a Jewish candidate for mayor to cross-endorse Zohran and to dispel any notion that Zohran is an anti-Semite or in some way represents a threat to Jewish New Yorkers. It was truly a beautiful and inspiring thing to see. Here's a part of an interview from the Stephen Colbert Show where Lander and Zohran expertly fielded this backhanded line of questioning a day or so before the primary.
Let's talk about the elephant in the room, is that there are many people in New York, even people who would support your candidacy otherwise, who don't want to support you because of the Jewish community's fear of the true and rising anti-Semitism, not only around the world, but in this country and shamefully in New York, which is the largest Jewish population of any city other than Tel Aviv in the whole world. And they are worried, they're very upset by some of the things that you've said in the past, and they're afraid that your mayorship would actually lead to increased anti-Semitism, that they believe that that would be more dangerous for them. What do you say to those New Yorkers who are afraid that you wouldn't be their mayor, that you wouldn't protect them?
You know, I know where that fear is coming from. It's a fear that is based upon the horrific attacks we've seen in Washington, D.C., in Boulder, Colorado. It's
all the way from Jews Not Replace Us to today.
And it's a fear that I hear also from New Yorkers themselves. You know, just a few days after the horrific war crime of October 7th, a friend of mine told me about how he went to his synagogue for Shabbat services, and he heard the door open behind him, and a tremor went up his spine as he turned around, not knowing who was there and what they meant for him. I spoke to a Jewish man in Williamsburg just months ago who told me that the door he left unlocked for decades is now one that he locks. And ultimately, this is because we're seeing a crisis of anti-Semitism. And that's why at the heart of my proposal for Department of Community Safety is a commitment to increase funding for anti-hate crime programming by 800%. Because to your point, anti-Semitism is not simply something that we should talk about. It's something that we have to tackle. We have to make clear there's no room for it in this city, in this country, in this world.
And no justification for violence of any kind?
No, there is no room for violence in this city, in this country, in this world. And I say this because I know there are many New Yorkers with whom I have a disagreement about the Israeli government's policies. And also, there are many who understand that that's a disagreement still rooted in shared humanity. Because the conclusions I've come to, they are the conclusions of Israeli historians like Amos Goldberg. They are echoing the words of an Israeli prime minister, Ehud Olmert, who said just recently, what we are doing in Gaza is a war of devastation. It is cruel, it is indiscriminate, it is limitless, it is criminal killing of civilians. These are the conclusions I've come to.
Stephen, can I?
Sure, please.
I mean, and by the way, before you answer,
yeah,
I want to say, if we're not able to fit everything in this interview on the broadcast, we will put the whole thing up online unedited. Okay, go ahead. So, look, I'm a proud Jewish New Yorker, raising two Jewish kids here is the joy of my life. I'm the highest ranking Jewish elected official in New York City government. I'm nervous about rising anti-Semitism. And also, I believe in the humanity and the human rights of Palestinians. And I know that it is possible. I support that vision of Israel as a Jewish and democratic state, but I hate what the Netanyahu government is doing in Gaza. And I've been saying that a long time. And look, no mayor is going to be responsible for what happens in the Middle East, but there is something quite remarkable about a Jewish New Yorker and a Muslim New Yorker coming together to say, here's how we protect all New Yorkers, Jews, Jewish New Yorkers and Muslim New Yorkers are not going to be divided from each other. We build a city where you have affordable housing and good schools and safe neighborhoods for everyone.
Well, Mr. Mamdani, how do you... I'm just curious.
What a mensch. What a mensch, this guy. And I'll tell you, those final couple of weeks where he was essentially campaigning for Zohran really earned Lander the respect and loyalty with the DSA that I'm sure will help him in the future if he ever decides to run for Congress or any other elected office for that matter. Not all lefties are going to agree with his positions on Israel 100%, but he has proven himself to be a team player when it mattered most. And there is a huge lesson to be learned here in terms of what solidarity and coalition building on the left actually looks like. Finally, I want to talk at the end of this discussion about what happens now. First of all, let's set the table here for what we know so far about this general election. Zoran will be on the ballot with a D next to his name, which is huge when you consider the number of voters who don't follow politics nearly as closely as you or me, who will just go into the voting booth and pull the lever for the Democratic nominee, no matter who it is. We also know that Eric Adams, the current hilarious and scandal-ridden mayor, will also be on the ballot as an independent. He's trying to rally supporters and has introduced this new and awesome chant to get people excited.
We utilize the letter F for faith.
Yes.
Our opponents use the letter F for profanity.
Yes.
So we need to stay focused. No distractions and grind. Focus, no distractions and grind.
Focus, no distractions and grind. Focus, no distractions and grind.
You gotta love them, folks. We also know that legendary right-wing vigilante and cat person Curtis Sliwa will also be on the ballot as the Republican nominee. He ran unopposed in the Republican primary, and just to give you an idea, he got more than 312,000 votes in the general election of 2021, losing to Eric Adams, but with almost 28% of the vote. Now that's a sizable chunk, especially when you consider that just based on how many votes Zoran got in the primary alone would amount to about 45% of the 2021 general election tally. So if Sliwa gets 28% in November, and Zoran gets the same number of votes he did in the primary, Eric Adams would have to expand his number from 2021 and do so without being the Democratic nominee, which is basically nearly impossible. And then we have Andrew Cuomo, who, at the time of this recording, is apparently still weighing running as an independent in November. It's pretty hard to imagine Cuomo making an honest effort at this point into the fall, because his donors have mostly signaled they'll abandon him in favor of Adams. Bill Ackman, the billionaire and former Cuomo donor, who is perhaps better known for going after college campus protesters and also for being friends with Jeffrey Epstein, has been leading the charge of billionaires who are freaking out over Zoran's win and are now trying to come up with a path to defeating him. I'll sometimes hear people make the argument that we should listen to billionaires because the fact that they've been able to accumulate so much wealth is proof that they are smart and know how to get things done. But then you read things like this piece, written by Andrew Rice in New York Magazine, that flipped that whole notion on its head. The article details some of the conversations happening in group chats between billionaires like Bill Ackman and his genius friends. Quote, "In text chains and on social media, some players tried to draw up triple bank shots. Could Cuomo hand over his line to someone like NYPD Commissioner Jessica Tisch, who could draw on her family hotel fortune? She has shown no interest in running. Could Sliwa, the talk radio vigilante and Republican nominee, be bribed or bullied into making way for someone more viable? A rumor made the round that John Katsimatidis, the grocery magnate who owns WABC, the radio station from which Sliwa took a hiatus to run, had offered the nominee $2 million to vacate the GOP party line, which technically may require him to move out of the city. Katsimatidis denied it, but he said that Sliwa, quote, had a contract with WABC forever and, quote, has to do what's right for him, stressing the importance of finding someone strong enough to beat Mamdani. Sliwa has vowed to stay in the race, quote, unless they figure out a way to put me in a pine box. In a missive on X, hedge fund blowhard Bill Ackman proposed his own galaxy brain idea. A write-in campaign, which would be simple if only a superhero stepped forward. And if fighting failed, he raised a second option, flight. Ackman calculated that if 100 or so of the highest taxpayers in my industry were to move, it would cost the city billions in tax revenue. The power of blackmail, though, has been diminished by repetition. The super wealthy bluffed about fleeing the city following Bill de Blasio's election in 2013 and again during the COVID pandemic. But they keep sticking around, and the city is flusher than ever with tax revenue. For all the talk of a millionaire exodus, personal income tax collections have increased without significant interruption since the pandemic. This year, they're projected to surpass $18 billion, double the amount of income tax collected during the last year of Bloomberg's tenure. The business community freaks out about everything, says one Macker, who was with Cuomo in the primary but sounded as if he was edging cautiously in the direction of a third camp, those who favor conciliation with Mamdani. Many of them are purely transactional. They're going to suck up to whoever is in there. I love the idea of these slick billionaires who have mostly backed Democrats now trying to bribe Curtis Sliwa, who, by the way, lives in a studio apartment with his wife and more than a dozen cats, and who was also once shot 5 times, he says, by people who worked for the mobster John Gotti. Yeah, I'm sure Curtis Sliwa is going to just roll over and take a payout from a bunch of Democrats who he hates to leave the city he's almost died defending. But what do Sliwa's supporters think about this plan? Listen to one of my favorite New York City political animals, MAGA performance artist and painter Scott Libedo, has to say about it.
Now, I hate speaking for people, but I think I'm all right to speak for Curtis on this subject here, because you're all talking about Curtis should team up with Adams and Curtis should be his deputy mayor. Like, fuck, shut up. If you all put this frightened fucking child energy that you have built up inside you behind Curtis right fucking now, we wouldn't have to worry about this cave-dwelling little fucking terrorists. And if it's going to be a team, Curtis is the mayor. He put 50 fucking years in. He earned it. He's the mayor, and Mr. Adams is second in command. I actually don't want him in any part of this fucking administration. This city is in a shitter, and this little cave-dwelling fucking terrorist man dandy is where he is because of Adams. He's not worthy of picking up fucking squirrel shit in City Hall. So it's Curtis and everybody or anybody else is second in command. Get that through your fucking heads. Bunch of fucking scared little wussies. Makes me fucking embarrassed.
Fuck yeah, Scott. You tell him. So what have we got then? A Democratic establishment in full-on meltdown mode. A floundering Adams campaign that's trying to rally its base around a scandal-ridden mayor who's now seen as a Trump collaborator who isn't even on the Democratic ticket anymore. You got Andrew Cuomo, who, whether he decides to actually run or not, might still be on the ballot come November anyway. And you got the beret-wearing cat lover and vigilante Curtis Sliwa, who got almost 30% of the vote last time around. I'd say, if the field holds as is, or close to it, until the fall, it is very hard to see how Zoran could lose. But of course, we've seen a non-stop, disturbing stream of racist threats and harassment thrown at Zoran's way from Republicans, including Donald Trump. And it's concerning in this case, both because of the very real threats to his safety, but also because of the way that the Trump administration has weaponized the immigration system in particular, especially against pro-Palestinian activists and immigrants. And let's be very clear, the aspersions of anti-Semitism or support for terrorism or whatever bullshit has been insinuated by Democrats like Kristen Gillibrand or Eric Swalwell or Kathy Hochul or Eric Adams or Chuck Schumer or Hakeem Jeffries or Joe Biden or Kamala Harris about the pro-Palestinian movement in general has paved the way for what the Trump administration is doing now. Donald Trump has now echoed the idea I first saw expressed by right-wing lunatic and racist congressman Andy Ogle, who suggested that Zoran be deported. This particular line of attack is troubling given the recent history of what happened to Mahmoud Khalil, Mohsen Mahdawi, and Reza Ozturk, all of whom were held in federal detention without criminal charge because of their participation in pro-Palestinian protests or even just writing an op-ed in a newspaper in Ozturk's case. Luckily, all of them have since been released from federal detention for now, but were waiting for the full adjudication of their cases as the Trump administration continues to push for their deportation. Now, Zoran has an added degree of protection given that he is a naturalized citizen since 2018. But what Ogle and Trump are suggesting is that the Justice Department should look into whether that citizenship should be revoked. Now, of course, this is a thuggish, extrajudicial, and abhorrent idea that should have everyone in this country up in arms. The idea that the duly elected Democratic nominee for the mayor of America's largest city should be deported is revolting and scary. It would be revolting and scary if it were anyone. but I think it's also worth understanding what the basis is for this idea, as bullshit as it is in the first place. Now, the insinuation is that because Zoran was a member of DSA before he became a citizen, he must have lied on his immigration paperwork, which does ask at some point whether or not you've been a member of any communist party. First of all, it's absolutely ridiculous to even have to answer a question like that on an immigration document. It's an absurd relic of the Cold War that such a question is still one people are forced to answer 35 years after the fall of the Soviet Union. You don't have to say whether or not, for example, you were a member of a far-right fascist political party or of a military dictatorship. Why should being a member of a communist party in the year of our Lord 2025 have any bearing on your immigration status? Second of all, I hope it goes without saying that the DSA is not a communist organization. It is a democratic socialist one, as the name itself clearly stipulates. In addition to that, I've also heard it argued that Zoran should have his citizenship revoked because in one of his rap songs, from nearly a decade ago, he said, quote, "My love to the Holy Land Five." The Holy Land Five were Palestinian-American members of what was the largest Muslim charity in the U.S., and I'm reading from a Rolling Stone article here. The group was convicted in 2008 of providing material support to the militant group Hamas, designated as a terrorist organization. The advocacy group Human Rights Watch has argued that the defendants in the landmark War on Terror case were never accused of directly funding terrorist organizations or terrorist attacks, nor were the Palestinian charities they funded accused of doing so. And other civil rights attorneys have found significant fault with how the charges were prosecuted. So the argument being made here is that Zoran in some way expressed support for terrorists and therefore shouldn't have been granted citizenship in the first place. Now, just given what's happened in the cases of pro-Palestinian activists who aren't citizens, I think it's going to actually be pretty difficult for the Justice Department or immigration officials to actually strip Zoran of his citizenship by way of the immigration and legal systems. It would be completely unprecedented in American politics, but I think we should all be aware and sober about this possibility, especially when you consider not just what Zoran has been able to achieve thus far, but what he's literally putting on the line here. Today, Donald Trump said on social media, quote, "As President of the United States, I'm not going to let this communist lunatic destroy New York. Rest assured, I hold all the levers and have all the cards. I'll save New York and make it hot and great again, just like I did with the good old USA." It's chilling when you consider that he's already sent 250 people to a gulag in El Salvador, for all we know, for the rest of their lives, without so much as criminal charges. He's defied court orders regarding some of those deportations. He's detained and tried to deport people who have spoken up for Palestinians. And he's also sent his goons out around the country to round up workers and old people and children with reckless abandon. He deployed the military to the streets of an American city to put down protests. One of Zoran's most impressive traits, though, has been his messaging discipline. Listen to how he responded to these threats from the president.
Yesterday, Donald Trump said that I should be arrested. He said that I should be deported. He said that I should be denaturalized. And he said those things about me, someone who stands to be the first immigrant mayor of this city in generations, someone who would also be the first Muslim and the first South Asian mayor in this city's history. Less so because of who I am, because of where I come from, because of how I look or how I speak, and more so because he wants to distract from what I fight for. I fight for working people. I fight for the very people that have been priced out of this city, and I fight for the same people that he said he was fighting for. This is the same president who ran on a campaign of cheaper groceries, who ran on a campaign about easing a suffocating cost of living crisis. And ultimately, it is easier for him to fan the flames of division than to acknowledge the ways in which he has betrayed those working class Americans, not just in this city, but across this country, and the ways in which he continues to betray them. Because we know that he would rather speak about me than speak about the legislation that he is shepherding through Washington, D.C. Legislation that will quite literally take health care away from Americans. Legislation that will steal food from the hungry. Legislation that looks to build upon one of the largest transfers of wealth we've seen in recent history in his first administration and do it once again for the very Americans who already have enough. We should be fighting for those that do not have what they need to live a dignified life. That is what I will do, and I am thankful to have the protection and to have the support of so many New Yorkers who have stood up and said how unacceptable this is, including our governor, including members of the labor movement. And ultimately, what I fear for is that if this is what Donald Trump and his administration feel comfortable about saying about the Democratic nominee for the mayor of New York City, imagine what they feel comfortable saying and doing about immigrants whose names they don't even know.
Zohran is not just the Democratic nominee for mayor of New York. He's doing what the Democratic leadership should be doing, and he's doing it perfectly. To wrap things up, I think we should take stock of this historic moment we're in. Not just because of Zohran's victory and what it means for the politics of the Democratic Party and of New York, but also because it exemplifies the sort of bravery and discipline that's required to take on the Trump administration. And I don't think it's a coincidence that leadership of this caliber, that's ensconced in humanism but also defiance, and that is so lacking in the Democratic Party right now, has come from the pro-Palestinian movement. Mahmoud Khalil spent nearly 3 months in federal detention for participating in pro-Palestinian protests at Columbia University. He missed the birth of his son, and he may still be deported to Syria at some point. Regardless, the day after he walked out of federal custody, he marched in a pro-Palestinian demonstration. And this past weekend, he appeared on stage with Zohran Mamdani and comedian Rami Youssef in New York City. It's moving to see such bravery and, frankly, righteousness shaking the decrepit and corrupt foundations of our political establishment. Of course, Zohran's platform is first and foremost about affordability, and it's centering that issue that will push him into office in November. But I also don't think it's a coincidence that the person who was finally able to galvanize a broad popular movement for the working class is being led by someone who emerged from the pro-Palestinian movement. I was at a film screening this past weekend where I saw an excerpt of a film about the Harlem Renaissance, and someone in the documentary, who was a prominent black poet from that time, said that back then, the writers and painters and musicians and activists and other artists who would be lionized forever in history as participants in a movement as significant as the Harlem Renaissance weren't really aware that that's what they were doing at the time. He said they were basically just living their lives, doing their work, collaborating with their friends, celebrating their accomplishments, and trying to make the world a better and more beautiful place. It wasn't until much later that history would come to praise them and their movement as one of the more significant cultural and political moments in American history. I'll leave you with that thought for now. If you are curious or interested in getting involved in the Zohran campaign, I highly urge you to do so. And ditto with the DSA. Thanks again, and please subscribe to the show if you haven't already, and tell all your friends and enemies to do the same. Bye-bye.